Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Today on our final program of the year, I am joined by a panel of esteemed journalists. Emmy Award-winning independent New Mexico journalist Peter St. Cyr, who has written for the Santa Fe Reporter and other publications this past year, Associated Press reporter Russell Contreras, and independent journalist Laura Paskus, whose work has appeared in the Nature Conservancy magazine, the Columbia Journalism Review, Al Jazeera America, the New Mexico Independent, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Among other publications, Laura also reports for New Mexico In Depth and KUNM. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for being here on this icy, icy morning. We appreciate it. As always, we invite your participation in the program. You can email us at collinshow@kunm.org or post your questions and comments online at kunm.org. Now, we have two independent journalists on our panel today, Peter St. Cyr and Laura Paskus. I imagine to some degree you can pick and choose the issues and events about which you write. What were you pulled toward to write about this year? And Peter, let's start with you.
Well, you know, obviously the big story has been the Albuquerque Police Department and the Department of Justice report that, you know, suggested some serious reforms. And so, you know, we looked at that, but we at the Albuquerque Free Press had to take a longer view because the publication comes out every 2 weeks. And so we really tried to look at the history and culture of aggression, not just in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years where the shooting trends seem to spiral upward, but for the last 4 decades. And we also wanted to kind of focus on the militarization of police. And then separately, I've been covering the medical cannabis industry for the last 7 years. We were on with you before to talk about that. And, you know, of course, this historic elections. And so being independent really does give us a time to pick and choose stories that we can become, that I like to immerse myself in. Because if you really can spend some quality time, I think you tell a much better and more complete story.
Now, what's interesting about several of those stories you mentioned is that they were year-long, the run-up to the election, the APD issue. So that gives a journalist something to really sink their teeth into, does it not?
Well, that's right. And the fact is that I think that readers, listeners, and viewers are paying attention and don't want just, you know, a quick hit, but that they want, as the story evolves, to be updated as well.
And just for our listeners, the Albuquerque Free Press online only, or are there hard copies as well?
It's actually mostly print and available in 400 locations throughout the city.
All right.
And
people,
Santa Fe.
All right. People can go out and look for that. Laura Paskus, let's turn to you. So in addition to what Peter has spoken about, what were you pulled toward to write about this year?
So I do a lot of reporting on natural resources, and in the past year, my focus has really been on water in New Mexico, in particular looking at what's been going on with the Rio Grande and also the state's decision to inform the federal government that New Mexico plans to build a diversion on the Gila River.
Let's just stop there for a second, because we're up here in Albuquerque, and I know there's coverage of it, but can you do a sort of a quick synopsis about that and why it's important to all of us here in New Mexico?
So in 2004, Congress passed the Arizona Water Settlements Act, which gave New Mexico access to 14,000 acre-feet of water a year. But the water doesn't just belong to New Mexico. We don't get it outright. New Mexico trades that water, exchanges that water with the Gila River Indian community in Arizona. And so New Mexico had a choice. We had 10 years to decide if we were going to use a federal pot of money to either meet future water needs in southwestern New Mexico through conservation and efficiency, or if we were going to use that money for to build a diversion on the Gila River. And so the Gila River starts in the Mogollon Mountains in southwestern New Mexico, as many of your listeners know, and goes through the nation's first wilderness area. So the diversion would be just downstream of the wilderness area. It's not in the wilderness area. And so, you know, the state had 10 years to decide, 10 years to do lots of different studies. And in November, the New Mexico Interstate Stream Commission voted to say, yes, we're going to build a diversion on the Gila River and inform the federal government of that decision.
Now, was it that stark of a contrast? You said there was conservancy and efficiency on one side and the diversion dam on the other. It's that stark of a contrast between the two choices?
It is. And the Interstate Stream Commission did decide to send some funding toward a few different conservation projects and studies and things like that. But the bulk of the real decision really was to say yes or no, New Mexico is going to build a diversion. And so critics of that point out the fact that there were some pretty major flaws with the engineering designs and that there's a huge gap between so the federal government will give New Mexico, I can't remember the exact number, but it's about $100 million or $66 million. I'm sorry, it's been a couple of months. But the price tag for the diversion could be $500 million. And so there's been no discussion of where that money, where that balance is going to come from, but it would likely come from New Mexico taxpayers.
I'm talking with a panel of journalists today. I've spoken with Laura Paskus and Peter St. Cyr. I'm about to talk with Russell Contreras about New Mexico news in 2014. You can post comments and questions for our panel on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio or on Twitter at KUNM News. Tell us, what were your top stories in New Mexico in 2014? Now, Russell Contreras, I don't know if you have the ability to choose topics and issues you will cover for the Associated Press, and depending upon the degree to which you can choose, what issues and events were you asked to cover the most this year, or what issues and events did you choose to cover the most this year?
Well, there were a number of stories that come out. I mean, one, of course, is the Albuquerque police shootings. We covered it as the incremental things were happening, especially with the civil disobedience going around in the city and how people were responding to the shooting of the homeless camper James Boyd in March, what that meant from the shutting down of city council to protests in the streets that forced authorities to use tear gas on demonstrators, to immigration and what was going down in Artesia. Those were stories that I looked at. Another one that came at me that put us in a state in national news was the shooting in Roswell. We had a school shooting down there in a middle school by a young man who brought a weapon and shot two students. That generated a lot of national attention. It brought back the debate over guns and mental health. And then that debate came back to Albuquerque with the shooting of James Boyd and what we should be doing with our folks struggling with the mental illness. So all that came back, and it was a consistent effort throughout the year to cover these stories. And they almost overlapped, whether it was questioning issues about transparency, where are we getting documents, what do we know is happening in various facilities, to how residents were responding to each of these stories. That, I mean, from January 1st down to even recent times, those stories are ongoing.
New Mexico seemed to be in the national news a lot this year. Did it seem like it was in there more to you this year, Russell? And how does that work? Do people make requests from other states? Hey, can we use your material? How does that work with you?
Sure. Well, the example of the police shootings, as we were covering it, and then it started making national news, when you had the cases out in Ferguson and then in Cleveland and then New York happen, and people started questioning where we are with the way we police our communities of color, they would then return and say, well, what's been happening lately? Oh, this happened in Albuquerque earlier this year. So all these stories started mentioning Albuquerque. By the way, earlier this year, this happened in Albuquerque. A similar thing happened in Albuquerque. What is being requested in Ferguson is the police to use lapel cameras. Well, that's something that's already been done in Albuquerque after we had a number of things happen to us. So what you saw was these communities coming back and looking at Albuquerque and seeing how we were responding. So in many ways, the events that happened throughout the country were happening here in New Mexico first and then almost setting the tone to what was going on the rest of the nation.
I saw a headline, though, online. It said Los Angeles is the first city to require police to wear lapel cameras. And I thought, I don't know if that's accurate. So maybe we're mentioned and then we're quickly forgotten. I don't know. So one thing that's true is that reporting itself can have an impact upon issues or events because something has been revealed or because the public's interest in an issue has been piqued. Peter, how did news coverage and reporting, local and national, impact or shape issues and events in New Mexico in 2014?
Well, I think that, you know, folks are, of course, interested in following the money and campaigns and campaign finance report. And that will continue to be something that evolves. And whether or not it's, you know, influencing elections, and if it's time for the Supreme Court maybe to take a second look at Citizens United case. So that was one of the big things here locally that I think kind of followed the national trends.
Well, when we saw the discrepancy between the amounts that our candidates for governor raised, that was pretty stark difference there, like 6-1 or something like that.
And then another issue that I kind of was monitoring and had the opportunity to follow and talk to some people that were there was kind of under this umbrella of immigration reform and all the women and children flooding over the border that got detained in Artesia at a federal detention center and their plight for asylum here in the United States. At first, they were just almost automatically and systematically being sent back to the countries they were fleeing because they feared brutality, domestic violence, even murder. And now all the lawyers that specialize in immigration law around the region flooded to Artesia and were able to put the brakes on and get these folks real asylum hearings. And many of them have succeeded at least in delaying the process and being able to have their voices heard and a legitimate hearing and not just this rush. And then, of course, immigration reform around the country. People have been waiting for 2 years with the Senate having already passed it and then the House holding up reforms. And so then the president, of course, has done the executive privilege. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in the next year.
All right. Let's bring in our first caller of our program today before as we approach our first break. It's Sarah from Albuquerque. Good morning, Sarah.
Yes. Thank you. Good morning. I just want to mention that what's important is that a lady got killed crossing Montgomery and San Mateo 3 weeks ago, and then the two other pedestrians got killed crossing in the middle of the streets. So that is three auto-related fatalities in like 3 weeks. And I just want to mention that our news need to cover more of the people killed crossing the street. We have about 80 to 90 fatalities in New Mexico per year in our state. And I think just in our Bernalillo County alone is like 50 to 60.
And so, Sarah, I just want to ask you, would you then like to see like an in-depth sort of piece about what's happening with drivers and the and pedestrians and care? Is that what you're saying? You'd like more coverage?
Well, right. Because the thing is, you know, yes, auto-related accidents are about 4,000 per year in the United States. And 2013, the people that died from when we had the lowest fatality rate, 2013 was 133 people died in alcohol-related accidents in New Mexico.
All right. So that's the contrast. All right. Well, I'm going to thank you for your call today. I'm going to get our panelist. Russell, you want to address that? Thanks so much, Sarah, for your call.
Yes, that's an interesting point. We had a story earlier this year looking at pedestrian fatalities. Pedestrians and automobile interactions and fatalities and so forth. And indeed, we ranked pretty high in
we
the nation.
We being New Mexico?
New Mexico, right. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is we don't have a walking culture. So like, you know, somewhere like New York, you have we walk all over the place and are in Boston. And here, it's a number of things. It's alcohol related. It's the way our intersections are set up. It's a number of things. It's the factors. So that's something that's being looked at. We have where these accidents are happening is we're an area where there's a higher concentration of homeless folks. Mm. And so you put in this mix, and it's a deadly mix. And it's something that needs to address, but it's really hard to address it because where do these accidents happen? Are they a result of pedestrians and they may intoxicate, or is it a result of somebody, you know, a DUI? So it's hard to address that problem and look at exactly, okay, what do we do to alleviate this problem? Is this something that we can do? Is this something that we can do structurally and change the engineering of our intersections? It's really hard to address, and we just don't know right now.
If people like Sarah and others missed that story the first time around, where can they go online to find that story? Can they just Google it, or is there a listing of AP articles somewhere?
Well, you know, you can Google it. The Associated Press, all our stories go to all the members in New Mexico. And by members, I mean all the broadcasters, all the newspapers. Some of these stories go nationally, so you'll see something maybe in Idaho or in the Washington Post. So if you Google those things and look up Associated Press, you'll get those stories. And a lot of times we are taking information from newspapers around the state so that you have a fuller picture, not just what happens in Albuquerque, but also what happens in Gallup or in Taos.
All right. We're taking a look at New Mexico news in 2014. I'm joined by independent journalist Laura Paskus and Peter St. Cyr, and by Associated Press reporter Russell Contreras. Join the conversation at 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number 1-877-899-5866. Tell us, where do you get your news these days? Are you still relying on traditional sources, television, radio, and print? Or do you find yourself getting the news via Twitter and Facebook or other less traditional online sources? We'll be back with you and our panelists after this short break.
Career advancement begins with business and technology training through UNM Continuing Education. Certificate programs and individual classes provide the latest information students need to succeed. Continuing Education offers solutions for employees and employers within businesses of various sizes and industries. For a spring class catalog, call 277-0077 or visit ce.unm.edu. A message from the tax-exempt UNM Continuing Education.
Manzano Day School, an independent school for children in pre-K through 5th grade, is accepting applications for the 2015 through 16 school year. Manzano Day School is dedicated to innovative child-centered education, excellence in teaching, and joy in learning. For a tour of the campus and information on the curriculum, visit manzanodayschool.org. A message from the tax-exempt Manzano Day School.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're taking a look at the news in 2014, and I'm joined by journalists Laura Paskus, Peter St. Cyr, and Russell Contreras, and you're welcome to join in our conversation. Let's bring our next caller in. It's Glenn from Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn.
Yeah, just one big thank you to all of you who've helped on the Call-In Show, to Elaine Baumgartel. I don't have TV. We got rid of TV years ago, just sick of the corporate media thing, all the advertisements. And for us and many we know up here in Jemez Springs, NPR, KUNM, you're our source. My son just got back from a week of helping translate and so on in Artesian, the detention center. And I would invite people to look at the New Yorker magazine that's coming out that's covering something, again, that the corporate media will not cover. And all of the women, no men, volunteer attorney who spent an entire week down there, they've now gone on to San Antonio to continue helping these women and children who fled violence. And thank you again for covering it.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning, Glenn. And we've already mentioned that issue a few times. It's, again, nationally and locally, it's in the news. So one thing that stood out for me in 2014 was how reporting, particularly national reporting, did not have an impact on an event this year, our governor's race. National publication Mother Jones published an investigative piece that cast our then incumbent governor and candidate, Susana Martinez, in a less than flattering light. I thought this reporting and follow-up reporting would tighten the race between Governor Martinez and then-Attorney General Gary King. Apparently, it did not. Anyone surprised by that? Was that surprising, Russell?
No, I wasn't surprised about it at all. I mean, recordings, the secret recordings itself would never have changed an election. I mean, we look at what happened with Nixon and Watergate, but that was fundamentally different. This, in many ways, may have even helped her because it felt like a privacy violation.
An intrusion.
Yeah, an intrusion, right. Yeah. And, you know, and what really, with the governor's race, what stood out to me was just the split amongst the Democratic Party. And you can really, we were talking about this with the panel of reporters yesterday. We can point to the primary system. There was really, the voter turnout was really low during the primaries and historically low in the general election. So people weren't engaged. So I wasn't surprised about the direction of the election. It seemed like the Democratic Party was split. You had five candidates. You couldn't get around it. After the primary election, there was nothing on social media. There was no buzz. Right there was a red flag. Anytime you have an election that's going to get heated, that people are excited about, right after the primary election, they rally around their candidate. It was absolutely silent right after the primary. I looked and I was like, did the election actually happen? Am I missing something? I see something on our wire that Gary King won, but nobody's congratulating. Nobody's saying I'm ready to go out and march. So this was that right there at point, so that Susana Martinez was in a good spot, and it showed on Election Day.
All right. Laura Paskus, you've begun a series for KUNM on the oil and gas industry. And all of us as consumers right now are liking these lower prices at the pump. But you're about to find out, if you haven't already, the impact that this may have upon our state. Tell us a little bit about, even over the year, the past year, I know looking ahead you'll be working on this, but tell us a little bit about what you've been working on with the oil and gas industry here in New Mexico, please.
So the series we're starting at KUNM, which is super awesome and everybody should check it out online, I'm looking at the natural gas and oil industries in northwestern New Mexico specifically, because natural gas drilling has been going on up there for decades. Fracking's been going on up there for decades. What's happening right now is exploration for oil resources. And so there have been about 100 what are called exploratory wells.
Now, is that a switch going back to oil now?
It's a big switch. Traditionally, northwestern New Mexico was entirely natural gas. Oil was down in the Permian Basin in the southeastern part of the state. So it's a really interesting series in looking at how that change in development is affecting local communities. You mentioned the lower gas prices, which is great, and also the fact that, you know, it's great for your personal pocketbook or whatever. And also New Mexico does get a lot of money from royalties when the prices are nice and high. But what I've really been struck by as I've been going out to these communities where oil and gas or natural gas has been occurring and the new oil development is starting is the impacts that these communities are suffering for the benefit of all of us. Is really something we need to think about. You know, there have been these really interesting instances of citizens saying, you can't drill in the Galisteo Basin. We don't want fracking in Mora. And I think that's wonderful when communities stand up for themselves. But really the thing that I've really been struck with in starting this series is that all of us in New Mexico benefit from the royalties, from the revenues that oil and gas bring.
Well, they go into the permanent fund, do they not? And there's been discussion in the legislature over the years about dipping into that fund. We may see, as a result of these falling prices, a resistance.
Right.
A renewed resistance to tap into that.
Right. And that's a huge issue and something that is, I think those are kind of two different pieces of the story, the fluctuating prices, and then also what to do with that money. But I really think it's worth people in the KUNM listening area thinking about, because I think development is very much tied to consumption. And if we're all going to be really happy about our lower prices and we want that revenue to be used for schools or, you know, different things, I think we really need to think about how these local communities, largely Navajo communities, are being impacted by the development up there.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that series that you're doing here on KUNM.org. Let's bring in our next caller. It's David from Albuquerque. Good morning, David, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask your professional panel there what happened to this story. Let me tie it in. Recently, just a few days ago, there was an incident downtown Albuquerque in front of Knockouts, so-called Gentlemen's Club, and it was an issue of a bouncer committing a felony battery against a patron they were removing, and that ties into there was an absence of police in the area to handle that at the moment, which is unusual because historically they've hung out there getting their bathroom breaks and drinks of water in the strip club for whatever reason. And that ties into this story. There's a Sergeant Carr, C-A-R-R, that months back was in the news because he was abusing the privileges of his badge, trying to date strippers, going to the length of arresting their boyfriends and then offering to follow them home after they had been drinking so that they wouldn't get pulled over by another cop. And I personally have witnessed Sergeant Carr commit other acts that one could say are illegal, and I was curious to me how that article or that news story just disappeared from everything. So I'd like to know, is there anybody who knows what happened to Sergeant Carr? And I'd like to stay on the line for your response, please.
All right, David, hang on with us. And Peter, you're indicating you'd like to talk.
So our good friends over at Channel 13 have been covering that story, and I do know that folks, the girlfriend was represented by a local attorney here, and the case is in litigation now. I don't know the status, particularly of Officer Carr, but it really kind of goes to the overall system of reform at APD with a new police chief that was sworn in February, and a new training curriculum. At the Albuquerque Police Academy. Today is the first graduating class since the DOJ report was put out in April, and it's class 111, which is, I think, kind of interesting symbolically that it's,
like a fresh start.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting, too, is that the police department has told us that they're going to not only train or change the training regimen, but that they were going to weed out people that maybe had some issues like this cop is alleged to have. And the class started off in June with 44 cadets, and today they're only going to graduate 32. Now, I don't know exactly what happened to the 12 that didn't make it through, but it looks like they are really taking a special look to begin this reform at that core level and weeding people out of the academy, where in the past, under pressure to boost the number of officers on the street, maybe they let people through more readily.
All right, so maybe we are seeing a change. David, you wanted to follow up in any way, just briefly, please?
I guess there's not much to follow up on.
Okay.
I appreciate Peter telling me what he does know, but I guess we don't really. We still. Main question was what happened to Sergeant Carr and his unacceptable behavior, and we still don't really know. So maybe your pros there could put it on their list of things to do to find out what happened with him, because a guy who does the things that he did, and like I said, I witnessed him personally doing other things like that have not yet been in the news, he doesn't need to be a cop. So I'd like to know what happened to him. If they could follow up on that, that would be great.
All right, David, we'll see if someone will jump on that. Thanks so much. If you'd like to join our conversation like David did by telephone, you can reach us at 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or on our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. We'd appreciate your participation. Now, Laura, when I wrote out to all of you and I said, hey, what's on your list? What do you want to talk about? There's something that appeared on your list that's been an issue for us here at KUNM, and maybe we can talk a little bit about why our listeners might be interested in this, and that's the lack of transparency by public officials, state and local. And we can talk about that a little bit with you, and then Russell, I'm curious whether you have had that issue as well. But Laura, tell me why that came up for you.
So, my role as a freelancer and someone who focuses on natural resources is, sort of like you mentioned earlier, as freelancers, we get to pursue stories that we're very passionate about or really interested in. And so I've been covering the Environment Department and the environment since 2002 and have seen sort of transparency issues in state government go up and down. Bill Richardson certainly had his staff members who protected him from unpopular questions during his time as governor. But what I personally have experienced and what some of my colleagues in the press corps have experienced is a difficulty in getting answers to unpopular questions from the state government. Of course, nobody wants to talk about certain things. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. But whether it's been the Environment Department, the Department of Game and Fish, I personally have had a lot of problems in getting access to public officials to be able to ask them questions, not sending emailed questions, but to have a face-to-face or phone interview to be able to ask tough questions sometimes, and to be able to follow questions, to not just and for me, the interviewing process is a conversation. It's mm-hmm. not just boom, 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 answer these questions. And so I think a lot of times journalists are having to rely on filing Inspection of Public Records Act requests in order to find information that in the past we might have just been able to get through a phone call. And, you know, I don't think that I'm unique in that. I used to be on the board of the Society of Professional Journalists Rio Grande chapter with my colleagues here in the studio, too. And I think that we just have been seeing a lot of issues with transparency on a state level, but also in local agencies, I think, too.
Well, Peter, go right ahead.
In January, taking a look at the militarization of police, not only here but around the country, asked the New Mexico State Police Department and the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department, as well as APD, for a complete list of their weapons inventory. I think that the public needs to know and has a right to know what kind of rifles they have, what kind of armored equipment and tanks they have, grenade launchers, rocket launchers. And interestingly, the Department of Public Safety and State Police and the sheriff's office readily gave it to us, even in electronic format, so we could sort it and look by type of weapon and year it was provided. But the Albuquerque Police Department has absolutely steadfastly denied our request to have access to the weapons inventory. And so, unfortunately, in New Mexico, the Inspection of Public Records Act gives you the right to pursue it in court. And I've spent the last couple of weeks with our attorneys deposing folks within APD, including the police chief, to find out why they are reluctant to be transparent and allow the public to understand if the department is becoming too militarized.
So you are pursuing it, but it's costing time and money, I imagine. Is that the only sort of resource that journalists have at this point, Inspection of Public Records Act?
That is the official act that allows folks to get access to all sorts of records, whether they be databases, emails, even text messages and phone messages, agendas, public meetings. And so it is absolutely something that is a tool for not just journalists, but everybody in the community.
And Russell, what's your experience been this past year or even prior to that with access to public officials for getting information?
It's been mixed. I would say this effort to clamp down on transparency is a nationwide thing. If you look with the federal government, we've had some serious issues with the Obama administration, and the Associated Press has come out and said that this is this has been a real problem during this administration, and a coalition of journalists have also said that. I've come in contact with the whole issue about immigration. It was very difficult to get basic information from the federal government about who's there. Now, after pressing, they would give you – it wouldn't be in a timely fashion. They would say, we deported this amount. There's this many there. But what I was really struck was that immigration authorities would tell the local officials in Artesia, this is how many people we deported. This is how many people have been let go. And then the mayor down there would tell us this number, and then I would call the federal government and immigration authorities and say, okay, he said this. Can you confirm it? Well, we can't confirm that yet. We're going to have to go through a proper channels to do that. So it may take a week for something they just told the mayor the other day. So, and I would ask this, why would you do that? Well, there are different protocols when I'm talking to a reporter. Well, there shouldn't be different protocols. It's the same data. And what really struck me, was really frustrating, is because it, the way the Obama administration handles immigration, you have to go through the White House. So you have local folks here who, you know, who are PIOs who work with reporters. They must get approval all the way to the top before they say give out basic information. Is an attempt to control the message rather than just to give reporters what they need. I'm not looking, you know, we don't have an agenda. We're not looking to get anybody. We're just trying to find the story and tell the story so that we can be accurate. And that has been a problem. And that that transcends all the federal agencies.
Okay, Peter, you wanted to mention something?
One of the things that's frustrated me, and I don't know if you get this, Russ, is that when a PIO, a public information officer or a government official, when you ask for the information, will say, who do you work for? And I think to myself, no, who do you work for? You know, democracy is best served when it's open and available to everybody. And at the end of the day, and I don't mean to be corny, but this really is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We already own the documents and the information. And if you are going to hold it secretively, we're going to go to court and we're going to get it because I already own it.
Well, and that, you know, that's interesting for me here. Of course, I've had my own frustrations with trying to get balanced panels. But as a member of the public, I always come down to, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but you work for us. You are public servants. You took that job knowing it, and you're denying us access to our documents. So I just wonder when the public is really going to grab onto that. Have you seen members of the public really starting to feel that? Laura, have you had any experience with that?
I don't know that I've had experience with that personally, but I think what Russ said is important to remember, that this is happening in the federal agencies. This is happening on a state level. This is happening locally. This is not a Republican or Democrat issue. Like, I think nationwide, there is this concerted effort to control the message and control information. That's really unfortunate. And I hope that the public does recognize that, one, there here in New Mexico, there are some heroes among the journalists in the state who are fighting for transparency, and people who are doing really good work. And I hope that people realize that. And I also hope that citizens recognize, like Peter said, that, you know, citizens can take advantage of IPRA and the Open Meetings Act as well.
Okay. We're talking about the New Mexico news in 2014 today. I'm joined by independent journalists Laura Paskus and Peter St. Cyr, and by Associated Press reporter Russell Contreras. There are many ways for you to join us today. You can call our line at 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. We'll be back with you after this short break.
Consider yourself fortunate when the ghost of Tax Day Future visits you in the middle of your favorite KUNM program, showing you next April 15th when your old vehicle is still parked and you're, sadly, wishing for more tax deductions, when you could have been smiling because you helped KUNM by donating it back in December and got a big tax deduction. There's still time to change your fate. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
On the next edition of Youth Media Project's Audio Revolution, it's the best of spring 2014.
If I wasn't human, I couldn't say that I was perfectly perfect today and yesterday.
People always ask what you want to be when you grow up, but we've always been told, and we accept it.
All this and more.
Listen to Youth Media Project's Audio Revolution this Friday at 8 a.m. on KUNM 89.9 FM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about New Mexico news in 2014, and a little later we'll look beyond into 2015. You can join us by emailing callinshow@kunm.org, or you can post your comments online at kunm.org. I do want to read Katie Stone tweeted us to say, I get all my breaking news from Twitter. Seriously true. It's faster than anything else. And breaking news, yes, but I'm curious because I was thinking today about the feedback that you all must get to stories that you write, and wondering on what platforms you get your feedback and how getting that feedback might influence you to either engage further in a story or look somewhere else? Let me start with you, Laura, and we'll go around the table. Just address that feedback issue, if you would, please.
Yeah, I seem to have a lot of listeners and readers who are perfectly comfortable calling me up on the telephone after a story has printed or aired. But definitely the feedback from Twitter is interesting. I have found new sources. Sometimes people who see a story and they're like, hey, you missed this point, or and then I know to sort of add that person to my contacts, and the next time I'm covering it, we'll check in with them to see an angle I might have missed. But as long as people aren't terribly mean, which sometimes they are, I really love getting feedback from listeners and readers on Twitter or via email.
Okay. And Russell, how about you? What kind of feedback do you get, and what does it propel you to do, perhaps?
Oh, I use all the social media platforms. We all do at the Associated. We have a big social media presence now on from the Associated Press on Twitter and Facebook. And it's another platform you use to get sources and to engage with the readers. And what we do with that is, you know, it's just like you're talking to a person on the street when you're trying to get a story. You can assess how credible or not credible this person is. What do they have to say? And, you know, and if they can give you more access to another story, story ideas, it's an incredible tool, especially if I'm looking for information that's happening on the scene. If I can get there and talk to this person, I use that as helping me craft something that's more compelling for the reader.
And Peter, how about you? Feedback, what role does it play for you?
Well, you know, obviously any kind of feedback is great because it makes you think. The thing about Twitter is a breaking news source, and I'm like Katie, I look at it, but I also temper it with like, okay, there's this chatter that I've heard via Twitter, but now I need to go confirm it with a legitimate kind of news source that's maybe vetted it. We remember what happened in Arizona a few years ago where, you know, Gabby Gifford was dead, and she wasn't. She was alive. And so I think Twitter is great from a news source, but mostly from like making me aware that there's something happening and I better go find out from a real big kind of news source that follows some standards and vetting the information.
Well, we've got a caller, Kurt from Albuquerque right now, who wants to talk about changing journalism in a digital era. Let's bring Kurt into our conversation. Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning. I actually think there's been not much change in how journalism is done in the digital era. I think stories are still produced as that stories. Sometimes they're presented as a series, but generally they're standalone stories in the journalistic tradition, with all the jargon and everything that goes with presenting those stories. But connectivity seems to rarely happen, even in independent media. A local example would be Terry Brandenburg, the district attorney, has done nothing but support the cops and has, you know, not wanted to bring any charges or push a grand jury indictment for any police officers since she's been in office. Yet as soon as she considers doing so, suddenly the police are investigating her, and they're presented as separate stories. On a national level, we look at the militarization of police and all the other shootings and everything, but we don't see it as a continuum. We don't see it as a continuum of the war on drugs and our prison industry and the rise of police unions and correction officers unions. None of these things are connected. They're all presented as separate issues.
So you'd like to see...
And I feel that digital feedback, you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, is meaningless. It's pointless because, you know, it doesn't really amount to anything.
All right, but you'd like to see journalists connect the dots more is what I'm hearing you say.
I'd like to do it, period, because I think it hardly ever happens.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning, Kurt. And those are Kurt's thoughts on the matter. Let's go ahead and bring in a couple of more callers. They're here. It's Tom from Santa Fe. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for letting me on.
Absolutely.
I guess I would like to point out that I think the big story of 2014 in the environmental area is the one that hasn't been written yet, and that is that the although the Gila River, the Interstate Stream Commission, voted to go ahead with the building of a diversion on the Gila, that it's really not going to happen. That this is the first time that there's really been substantial public opposition to these boondoggle programs that in the past have always just sort of flown through on the benefit of, you know, big construction. And the other piece of that, excuse me, the other piece of the environmental thing is that we have made huge progress in protecting lands in New Mexico. There's the two new national monuments. The Valles Caldera has been turned over to the National Park Service. And there's the Columbine Hondo Wilderness. And those things for which we can thank our congressional delegation will pay huge benefits in the future in terms of, excuse me, economic development.
All right, Tom, let's rescue you from your coughing fit, and let's get Laura Paskus to join us in this conversation. Thanks so much for calling today. Laura, you want to comment on what Tom had to say?
Absolutely. So he brought up a great point that there was a ton of citizen involvement on the Gila, people contacting their legislators.
On which side
campaigns.
Of the equation? I may know, but I...
The anti-diversion folks showed up to public meetings. They were a vocal opponents to the diversion, and he's right in that the diversion isn't going to happen anytime soon. And the last story I did for the Santa Fe Reporter on the Gila issue back in November, I pointed out that it's likely if the diversion were to go through, if sort of the project made it through all the federal hoops. It would be 20 years until ground was broken. And I think my impression from sitting through the final meeting when the Interstate Stream Commission voted, it seemed to me as though some of the commissioners did not understand that. And one in particular seemed taken aback that it would be 20 years before this diversion would be built. And Tom is right about the public lands issues. There have been a lot of protections enacted on lands this year. I think one thing for people to think about in 2015 is to see what happens with the state land office, because that's going to be a really big deal with Ray Powell out of that position. It will be very interesting to see what happens with those state lands if they are protected.
You know, I'm curious what you hear from people like the people who went down to participate in all the meetings about the Gila, and they put their passion in it, their energy in it, members of the public, and then maybe they end up feeling like, oh, were we even heard? Do you hear people saying we're going to continue on, or is it discouraging? Do you ever report on that aspect of it as well?
You know, I've been covering what's been going on with the Gila for just a few years, and have seen a lot of the same faces at the meetings. And I think that it was discouraging for people to feel like their voices weren't heard when people really did pour a lot of effort, you know, driving from Silver City all the way up to Albuquerque or Santa Fe for a meeting, that sort of thing. But I also get the impression that this wasn't just like a passing campaign for people. This wasn't just like a click like on Facebook kind of issue for a lot of the people involved. And I don't think that they're going to give up or, you know, find a new issue to work on. I think that a lot of the people working on that are in this for the long haul and trying to see the Gila protected.
Now, we had a caller talk about wanting reporters, journalists to connect the dots. And one of the things that I've enjoyed this year in particular, and maybe it's as people's consumption of news via the internet grows, is whether it's the Santa Fe New Mexican, whether it's KUNM, whether it's the Albuquerque Journal, is putting together a series. And online, you can go to a central page. Let's say the New Mexican just did something about WIP, and you can access all the previous stories. They're all listed there. There's a timeline. And that online has made a consumption of media a lot easier, and really we can all get better informed when we can look at all those progressive stories on an issue. Have you noticed that yourself, Russell, or participated in it?
Yeah, the Associated Press on our app, our mobile app, whether it's for your iPad or your iPhone or a smartphone or another application, we do have something where you can go and you can look and say all the Ferguson stories, all the immigration stories. And this is what's really interesting about this is that It covers when you click on something in Ferguson, you'll see something, but then you'll see something about the Cleveland police and JOA probe. JOD, and you see that, and you can put it in perspective, looking right there with the, on your iPhone, and put things and look at it, not only what's happening in your local communities, but what's happening around the country, also international. When something big happens, let's say the mining accident in Chile, for example, you could go there and see the series of stories. And what the Associated Press does is we take the information from local news sources that with our members, they subscribe to the Associated Press. So it's not just AP reporters. It's reporters there on the scene. So you get that and you'll have a fuller picture. And I think a lot of people want that. With the way the media industry is working right now with our declining news holes, there's not a lot of space in newspapers. There's not a lot of time on television. It's nice to have these resources where you as a reader can go back and look at a series, because in a day we may not be able to give you anything, but we can store it for you to go and get a larger picture.
Yep, very good for the people who are consuming it. Let's go ahead and bring in perhaps our last caller today. It's Paul from Albuquerque. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I just wanted to give a little note of appreciation for journalists. I guess I'm speaking from prejudice, since I'm a former journalist, freelance for a while. But I know that journalists are sort of on the front line of our democracy, and I think that they're pretty hardworking. When you always compared it to an iceberg, you see the tip of their work, but you don't see all the work. And especially for a freelancer, it comes down to maybe a nickel an hour. If you worked out your time that you put into it, and now, you know, and back in the olden days, you should be able to actually call up the mayor and get an interview. Now you got to run through a gauntlet of spokespeople and all of these freedom of information requests, so the job is even tougher. So I just wanted to give a big hats off to these folks and other folks who do the hard work every day.
All right, and thanks so much for that call, Paul. And you can bask for another moment. We're going to bring Clifton in, who may have another viewpoint. And very briefly, if you can, Clifton. Nope, Clifton, are you with us? Clifton is no longer with us, I would imagine. So let's go to a different, just very briefly, again, we're almost near the end of our show. What is on each of your radar screens for 2015, for 2015? Peter, what's on your radar screen?
Well, certainly, you know, to beginning the year, it's going to be taking a look at the new political dynamics in Santa Fe with the state legislature, and just to see what kind of new rules maybe roll out with the medical cannabis program.
And we didn't talk about medical cannabis or any other of the marijuana-related issues, but people can go to the Santa Fe Reporter and find lots of work that you've done on that, great work that you've done on that. Thanks for that, Peter. Russell, how about you? What's on your radar screen?
With the upcoming legislative session, I believe we might have something, new reforms on mental health reforms. We might get a Kendra's law here, and that's a law that would require anybody suffering from mental illness, if they're not taking their medications, to get a court-ordered treatment, outpatient treatment. We're one of five states that don't have that. It's a debate that we've been having for years, but I think there's been a change, and we may see something on that.
Well, are you and are you hearing that as you're talking to people in preparation for the upcoming session? That's something you're hearing?
It's something the lawmakers are really concerned about, especially what's going on in Albuquerque and with the shootings. I mean, 75% of those who've been shot were suffering from mental illness, according to the authorities.
All right, we shall see that. And Laura Paskus, how about you? What's on your radar screen for 2015?
So energy development is a big one, climate change and water, and I'm really excited to see what else Patrick Malone comes out with on WIP.
Well, and we had Patrick on last week, and certainly those stories are developing. And how about on the oil and gas? What can we look forward? What's your next area of exploration there yourself?
So after the holidays, we'll be rolling out some more stories on infrastructure, community impacts, public health, environmental impacts, water, fracking.
Okay, a large number of issues. Well, thanks to our guests, AP reporter Russell Contreras, independent New Mexico journalist Peter St. Cyr, and Laura Paskus. You can find a podcast of this and other KUNM call-in shows online at KUNM.org. Jefferson White has engineered the show today. Marisa DeMarco is our assistant producer. Ed Williams handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. On behalf of everyone at the KUNM Call-In Show, we wish you happy holidays, peaceful ones, a joyous end to your year. This is the KUNM Call-In Show on 89.9 KUNM, broadcasting live from the University of New Mexico.